How you doing?
I am doing well. Thanks for asking. Good. Yeah.
Good.
Feeling good.
Good.
Mm-hmm. It's a good time to do what I do.
It seems like it's got to be one of the most important times. I don't want to put words in your mouth. How would you rank this time in history?
Yeah, you know, I've been waiting for this my whole life. You know, I've been waiting for this my whole life. And it has impacted me in ways that surprised me. And I have never been more excited because, you know, it's not my career. I mean, you know, diversity work isn't my career. It's my soul. And I've always thought that people were going to come together in a new way. That's in my bio. It's in the stuff that I've been saying. I think I said it on your radio show before when we did our interview several years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it comes from places where you don't expect it to come from. And it's beautiful to me. And something that is exciting and beautiful to some people is frightening to other people. And they're both happening at the same time.
We're talking to Terrell Ross. Terrell Ross has over 30 years of experience working in equity and social justice. He examines the intersectionality of race, climate change, new media, changing demographics. He's the founder of Mosaic Nation, a social justice learning community. What has surprised you most about the past, let's call it a month?
That it impacted me personally. I've been doing social justice work my whole life, and I realized that I've either been doing it wrong or I'm not doing enough. So on one plane, there's society, and the thing about that is that people from all walks of life have said enough, and they are coming together. This is just the beginning of what I think is going to be a very long, sustained ground war, and it's going to affect different people at different times, and it's not going to go in a straight line, but yeah, you know, it's here now, and I'm enjoying watching it. So I guess, you know, that it's collective and it's also personal.
The personal part, how have you coped with the personal part? Has it been fulfilling because it confirms stuff you've been talking about for decades and reaffirms work that you've been trying to do? Has it been painful because it triggers deeply felt understandings and experiences? How have you managed personally?
Well, you know, the first thing that happened, so it was all about the George Floyd, you know, incident.
Yeah.
And the first thing that happened, and there was a point in there where I was led to tears, and we'll talk about that. But it just made me just be thankful for my parents, because my parents are, you know, Black parents. They had six kids, and they lived their life. You know, they face racism in a way that's far deeper than anything I face, but they live their life with dignity and pride, and they treat it like they treated all people in a beautiful way. And I just felt very proud to be their child. And I felt very proud for the things that they had to endure that I've probably underestimated. I don't know where that came from. And then the second thing I thought during this time was just what a humiliating way for a man to die. Like,
yeah.
I actually think it was a execution. You know, it's one thing if somebody pulls a trigger and does a, you know, has a bad moment, but this person's, you know, had his knee on his neck for what, 8-9 minutes. And have you heard the there was a man on CNN, I think his name is Donald Williams. Have you heard him? He was a witness of the murder.
Oh, I don't know. Was he one of the people who filmed it? Was he one of the people that captured the sound, or was he just somebody who was interviewed after?
I can't remember.
I don't remember either. But anyway,
yeah.
Keep going.
But so he was on CNN with Chris Cuomo, and when I heard that, like that's what changed everything for me, because you know, it's funny because he was a little shy at the beginning. He'd never been on TV before, and he was kind of going off on these tangents. And then all of a sudden, he just went right back to that place. And he started crying, and he started talking about what it was like to see this man that was intent on hurting this other man when he didn't need to. And you could hear his humanity come out. And he, you know, talked about that the man, you know, begged for his mother. And, and it was his eyewitness that I was like, wow, it just really rocked me. I was sitting there, you know, crying, watching it. And I just said, man, I got to do more. So, and when you watch the video, you'll see what I mean.
The it was 8 minutes, 46 seconds was the time period. And yeah, it was, I'm wondering if that is what led you to tears. That was the moment that led you to tears, or were there other moments? Because I think there were maybe millions of tears, maybe billions of tears shared and shed across the country in the wake of that. I think that that emotional experience for so many people, I can at least speak for myself, is related to how sustained the reaction has been, with a different reaction than with Michael Brown in Ferguson, with a different reaction than, a different reaction certainly than Rodney King. Was that what triggered your tears, or was it something else?
I've seen that look before. What he described was evil. And I never put that together. And, you know, when you really think about it, there was a man who was intent on harming someone. You know, he did an oath. Once upon a time, I did an oath when I was an officer in the Army. This man, the police officer, did an oath to protect and to serve. And there he was. What's so weird about this is that there were people who were around him who were telling him, hey, he's subdued. He's no threat to you. You know, let him, you know, his arms are behind his back. And the man, he wouldn't respond. And it was one thing when you see the video, but when the man was sitting there watching him talking about it, that's when it just went through my soul, because I've seen that look. You know, my dad, when he was a young man, he got ran over by a bunch of, there was a white guy in a motorcycle that ran over my dad, and my dad had this big scar in his neck, and, you know, but that wasn't a police officer. And, you know, when I was in the military, one thing I remember is that one of my bosses said that if when you're in the Army, and if you ever see anything that is wrong or that will harm someone that is in our Army, you have an obligation to stop it. You must stop it. And the fact that the other three officers did not intervene, I don't know if you know this, but the dispatcher who could see from the camera, the dispatcher actually tried to call the police officer and say, what are you doing? And then there were all these people around. And I think what made the scene so powerful is that none of them felt that they could intervene. They were afraid to intervene because they knew that the police probably would have shot them. The whole thing was a 21st century execution. It was a 21st century lynching, and it touched people in their hearts. You know, the similar thing is what happened in the civil rights movement. A lot of people don't know this, but when Martin Luther King used to go wherever he was going to go, he'd always call the media. And back then, you know, we only had like three or four stations. Most people still had black and white TV.
Sure.
And there was something about those incidences when they had these dogs that they were sicking on older women and kids. You know, when it was the angry young black men getting killed, people lived with that. But when they started sicking those dogs and all of that, it moved people in their soul. And I think that this is that type of event for the 21st century. And it's the toothpaste is out of the tube, and we're not going back.
Well, let's use that as the segue. How do you imagine the future? And you can characterize that future as the next 3 months. You can characterize that future as the next 3 years or three decades. But as you've thought about scenarios of how the arc of the moral universe is impacted by the past month or 5 weeks, how are you imagining that world?
I think, well, like I said, we're at the beginning of something that's going to be long and sustained. It's really at this point focused on black lives and police reform. But ultimately, what I think is going to be the greatest legacy is that it's going to be about class. Because the one thing that COVID has done is it has exposed the inequality that's germane to our society. When you realize, and that's another part of this, that, you know, how many people depended on schools to feed their children? How many people have not been able to learn from home because they don't have computers or technology at home? Like, you know, the rich are far richer than we think, and the poor are far poorer than we think, and it's all like in front of us. And I don't know if you're a football fan, but
I grew up a huge football fan. I have to say the concussion stuff shook me a little bit, not even consciously. But yeah. I'm less of a football fan now. I used to be a rabid football fan. I had Tony Dorsett, Roger Staubach, and Eric Dickerson and all on my wall as a kid.
Oh, wow. Well, that's awesome.
I mean, not the human, you know, just the poster.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things, so all of these things are related that we're going to talk about today, but the NFL had their draft, and what they did is they took us into the homes of all these people, and they were so white and they were so male that it disturbed me, and they were so rich, and
the homes of which people? The homes of
the executives. The
executives of the team.
So they had the general managers and the coaches.
Yeah.
For each team. So it's 32 teams.
And the commissioner of the league, maybe.
And the commissioner, he was down in his plush basement and all of this. But, you know, I mean, you know, I've been in homes of rich people, but that they were so non-diverse, it was shocking. And so I think you have that. You have people who are struggling for food. You have people who are losing their jobs. You know, I don't know if you saw the bus driver. It was this one bus driver, black man, you know, really seemed like a really cool dude. And he was kind of getting mad at someone who wasn't wearing a mask. And then the person coughed on him. Well, this black man ended up dying. Like, so all these lives of normal people and maybe some people who are living, you know, abnormal lives, it all is kind of in front of us, playing out in front of us. And it gives us a perspective on where we've been and where we're going. And so I think that, that's a class part is the stuff that we don't talk about, but it's ultimately going to be kind of where everything's going
to
go.
And with the NFL example, what I heard you saying is not only did you have a chance to see the inside of the team owners, team executives, team commissioners, their white faces and their affluent residences, but then potentially juxtaposed with players getting drafted, which itself is an odd dynamic. And NFL draft ain't all drafting white people, to be clear.
Exactly. And it was every now and then you have things that give you a moment of awareness. And so one of the first moments of my life one time was when I was flying, you know, and I've lived in the Pacific Northwest most of my life. I lived in Germany and I used to live in Philadelphia. I lived in the projects when I was really little. But one of the moments that really struck me was when I went to the Atlanta airport. And so I was in the airport and man, it's like chocolate city, you know, I mean, you just see black people everywhere, all shade, size and difference. And
even the E channel Real Housewives series of Atlanta is different than the other cities.
Oh, I bet. And what was so powerful was that everybody that worked in the Atlanta airport was black, except for the pilots and the crews. It was just stunning how, you know, the class difference. And I felt the same way when I watched the NFL draft.
I remember when I grew up in South Pasadena and Portland, Oregon, and both pretty white places, but my circles of friends tend to be pretty diverse, tend to include pretty broad swath of people. I did a summer in Washington, D.C., and I was living with a family friend in Bethesda, Maryland, and then running a summer program for inner city kids in Northeast DC. And I will never, ever remember, I would get on the metro, at Chevy Chase at a stop in Bethesda, Maryland. And it would be literally every single person on that metro train was white. We would then get to Metro Center. There are a couple other stops where there was a lot of turnover. Metro Center was the key turnover. The entire train would empty. It would then fill entirely again. And I'd be the only white person left on the train. And it'd be fully full again. And I had not experienced, right? Portland was a white place, but not as obviously segregated to me, and partly because my own lack of awakening. But it had never, it was so stark to me. And now I recognize myself that you mentioned with the NFL draft and other examples of it, more people in America, we think, we hope, having that kind of visual experience. Is that your impression, that more people are now observing what's actually been happening in the world for more than just the last month?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we're all isolated. And so I think that that has something to do with it, where people are looking for different things. You know, we have more time with ourselves. We probably think and go places that we don't normally go. And there's just a lot of what I call truth that has been given to, like, it's a gift to me. You know, I mean, beautiful things have come out of a horrific, you know, incident or incidences. There, you know, he's not the only one that that's gotten killed during this time. And I just think that we're being overrun with truth, and it's affecting different people at different times.
You talk about class. Before I get into that, I want to make sure we don't skip over, because what I heard you say is right now it's about Black lives and it's about police reform, and you see it expanding, morphing, evolving, including overall class struggle and social justice generally beyond that. But before we skip over that, let's get to Black lives and police reform. One of the questions that's been coming up a lot is how are the best ways, what are the best ways for this energy, while it is still so salient, to be channeled, to be focused, where you have a chance to advocate for channeling that energy. And of course, it's not up to any of us exactly. Where are the places you hope energy gets channeled specifically? If you had a group of protesters who you were talking to, or just a, you know, a bunch of people in a Twitter feed, where is focus you want to be directed? And potentially, where do you think there's stuff that's being underappreciated or missed?
Well, at the end of the day, it needs to be focused on action. And I don't know if it was on your show that I said this, but it was after the Trayvon Martin thing, and there were all these people that were protesting. Yeah. And, you know, I kept saying, you know what, you want to honor Trayvon Martin, excuse me for cursing, change that damn law. You know, that's how you honor Trayvon Martin. You change the center of the Stand Your Ground law, because in Stand Your Ground, all you have to do is feel threatened. You don't have to be threatened. Change that law. And all those people who march, they never change the law. And so that's my short answer to that. But what I would say is that, have you ever read the letter from Birmingham jail from Martin Luther King?
I have.
Okay. Well, what's really interesting,
not because I'm sufficiently well read, but because we were assigned to it in college.
Okay. Well, that's perfect. It's a great, you know how it's very long, but it's awesome. Right. And so, but one of the things that's really interesting in it is he talks about his four stages of nonviolent protest. I always make sure I want to get him. So the first one is get the facts. The second one is negotiate. But the third one is a weird one that kind of comes out of nowhere. And it's called self-reflection, which I was like, well, wow, like, you know, get the facts, negotiate with self-reflection. And then he says, then you protest. And so what he's really saying is do your homework and then always try to work with the other side. And then find out and be clear about what you're doing and why you're doing it, and then go do what you have to do. Remember when the Occupy movement was going on and they were putting in these microphones? You probably interviewed people and say, hey, and I was actually disappointed because a lot of people could not articulate why they were doing what they were doing. So I think people, what my saying is bloom where you're planted. I don't think that this movement is going to be a movement. I think it will be several movements that are combined. In the civil rights time period, you had what we now know as the civil rights movement. We also had a women's movement going on. We had an anti-war Vietnam movement going on. And then something that never gets talked about, but what was called then the Chicano community and the Filipino community came together and did a grape strike. So you had these multiple movements that were going on, and I think that's what we're going to have now. We're going to have multiple efforts that are going on. And I just think that that people should do, like I'm not a protester. So, you know, I'm sorry to say that, but that's the truth. I'm not a protester. My brother goes to protest, but there's a place for me in this movement. There's a place for you in this movement. And I think people have to figure out where their place is and then go deep.
How did you make the decision to apply your energy where you have? Why have you decided not to be a protester? And that's not to put any burden on you. How you spend your energy is how you should spend your energy. And the burden I would put on would be on people who've been part of the problem rather than part of the solution. But how have you made that decision?
Well, you just actually gave my answer. It's like because one of the, you know, I'm a diversity person and I work in diversity, you know, all my whole life. And one of the reasons that diversity has struggled so much is because we try to do everything. You can't do everything. You have to pick what in the military we call the critical few. In a movement, in a war, there's room for everybody to contribute. You know, some people have time. Some people have money. Some people have the ability to do research. Some people have the ability to make people laugh and be motivated. Some people have the ability to go out and recruit other people. And the movement that I want to be part of, the movements that have meant the most in my life, we've been able to have everybody contribute. And so, I think protesting is important, but it doesn't motivate me the way that I think it motivates other people. And so I'm proud of the people who do it. I'm in solidarity with those people, but I'm doing where I think I can make the biggest impact. There's things that I think I can do well.
Where are those? It's a time like this where some of your life's work feels in its highest relief. What are those couple things? What is your critical few or your piece of the critical few?
To work with others in solidarity. I think we are entering a solidarity movement. Now, solidarity is different than what most people of my generation, I'm 60 years old, I'm a baby boomer. Solidarity doesn't mean that I'm always gonna agree with you. It doesn't even mean I'm gonna like you. And I identify as a person of color. I grew up by a military base. I was born in a foreign country. I know people from all walks of life. You look at my Facebook page, it looks like the United Nations. And I think that there's something in our society that makes it difficult for people to work together. And the problems that we have are so complex, because we haven't even talked about climate change yet. But the problems that we have are so complex that if we don't start working together, like now, we're all in trouble. And I think that I have a history of working with people across difference to get somewhere. I was lucky when I was at the University of Washington as a student, I created this group called Mosaic, which stands for Multicultural Organization of Students Actively Involved in Change. And we worked for the better part of 8 years. And we ended up being the first student group in the country to build a plan, diversity plan, that was signed by the president of that university and its regents. And we did this big ceremony. We're actually coming up on a 20-year anniversary. And, you know, that's neither here nor there. Yeah, thank you. That's neither here nor there. But what's so powerful about it is, you know, we were all, you know, I was relatively young, you know, in my 30s and 40s. Now I'm in my 60s. And we thought that we were going to go everywhere and that was going to happen everywhere we went. And pretty much to the person, you know, every night, because we're all over the country and doing different stuff. And we all kind of laugh and go, you know, that's just like winning a championship. And when you win it, sometimes you think you're always going to win one and da, 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 da. But we realize that the lessons that we learn are very powerful. And now we have to find the ability to do it in places that didn't have the camaraderie or whatever we had. We just got lucky. But we've been part of that. And we think that that's what's needed now. And I think I can be part of that. as a researcher and an educator. You know, John Lewis just died, right?
Of course, it was one of the things I was going to ask you about.
Yeah, and so what's so interesting about him, I got to hear him speak, you know, a few years ago, and that was just really inspirational. They allude to him a little bit in the movie Selma, so people who have should watch the movie Selma. Sure. But what made John Lewis so special that is a little bit underrated is when Martin Luther King Jr. came, there were a lot of young Black people that had been part of this struggle, these struggles, and they were doing stuff. And they didn't really like Martin Luther King Jr. They didn't dislike him. They thought he was a good thing. But whenever he came, everybody would kind of gravitate toward him, and then they would maybe ignore the people that had been doing the work. That's just normal, right? And so they were a little resentful of him, you know, sure, for getting all the press and all of the stuff. And everybody who knows anything about him knows that that wasn't who he was anyway, but that's not how sometimes young people think. And so what was so powerful, what made John Lewis so powerful, is he says, you know what? We're going to work with that man because he's got the same goals that we have. He may, you know, try to get there differently, but we're going to be stronger together. And if it hadn't been for him, you know, maybe some of the greatest accomplishments that Martin Luther King Jr. had wouldn't have happened. I just think today we need a diverse coalition in the things that we're going to try to do.
So I think what I heard you say is that John Lewis maybe had a humility, that he saw Martin Luther King, and instead of reacting in a manner of jealousy or no, my piece has got to be, the thing I'm working on has got to get more attention, instead say, no, let's go in and work with this cat. He's getting a lot of attention, and that could be good. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah. So I had this wonderful young man, African-American man, that I've worked with, and we like each other and we agree with each other. And then we had made an agreement for something, some social justice thing that we were going to do. And then finally at the last minute, just before it happened, he didn't kind of do his part of it. And I was like, hey, what happened? You know, like, we're a team, and da 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 da. And I said, why did you go off on your own and do it that way when we had already agreed to something else? You know, like, you know, just as an older Black man, as someone that you could consider a mentor, I wouldn't do that to someone. So what's up? You know, talk to me. And he said something that really disappointed me, actually. He said, well, you know, once you got involved, we didn't want you to get all the credit. And I was like, man, are you kidding? I don't care about credit. I could care less about credit. I'm not going to go put my name on this. You know, it's all about getting the work done. You know, what did Marshawn Lynch talk about when he was being interviewed during the Super Bowl? And they said, oh, you don't seem to have a lot to say. He goes, hey, I'm all about that action, boss. I'm here to get something done. And it really broke my heart, because that young man was more interested in who got credit than he was in getting stuff done. And like I said, you know, that's, I guess this is emerging as one of the themes of our interview, is that it's time to get stuff done. It's time to roll up our sleeves and move the needle. There's lots of needles that have to be moved. It's probably much more dire than people realize. And in a way, all of this is an opportunity.
You brought up Occupy, and one of the critiques of Occupy was, one of the questions raised was, well, what are the set of objectives that will demonstrate some degree of impact of this movement or set of movements? Okay. Similarly, now we're hearing a question, and there have already been examples of impacts. Already cities have started changing their own laws. Yeah. As you want to elevate proposals for transformation, as you want to use your word, change that law, as you, to use your Marshawn Lynch's...
I said, change that damn law.
Or change that damn law. If you want to be like Marshawn Lynch and be about that action, what is that action? What are those laws that you're wanting to elevate?
Well, before I answer that, I do want to say that most of my experience with police officers has been positive. Not all of them. My personal opinion, this is just my personal opinion, but I think probably 90% of the police officers are fine. There's probably 10% that are rogue, that I think are, that have been, you know, part of a lot of this. So one law that I would change is that, you know how we have a list of sex offenders, right? So if someone's a sex offender, I think that anybody that violates that oath to protect and serve and commits a felony that has been determined by a jury of excessive force when someone gets killed, I think that they should be put in a database, just like sex offenders. They should go everywhere. I think that we have to change the training that happened, because right now there's a kind of like a code. I know this much about law enforcement. There's kind of this code of conduct about how officers work with each other. And right now it skews towards kind of, you know, like letting people get by. So for instance, when I think it was Darren Wilson who did the thing with Michael Brown, when they had some problems and he ended up shooting him, when he went back to his police station, he said, oh yeah, this happened. They didn't even cross-examine him or ask him any critical questions. They just basically let him say what happened. And then there was no protocol in place to say, oh, wait a second, you know, we need to check this, that, and the other. There wasn't even a dialogue. I think the stand your ground law probably, like, I'm all for people who want to have guns to protect themselves in their home. I don't think people need assault weapons, but that's a different thing. But I think the fulcrum for stand your ground is feeling threatened. And I think it should go from feeling threatened to being threatened. So what made the George Zimmerman situation so interesting was, have you ever heard the 911 call with?
Yeah, multiple okay. times.
And you know, it's a whole different thing when you hear the 911 call, because he called 911 operator and he says, yeah, there's a suspicious looking guy. And at no point, you know, did the person thinking it think it was a black person, right? You know, there's a suspicious looking guy. And then while during the call, so Trayvon Martin, I think, lived in a gated community that was mostly white. And I think it was raining, if I'm not mistaken, and it was in the evening and he had a hoodie on. And so he's talking to his girlfriend on the phone and he sees someone looking at him, pointing at him. And so he actually moves away from the person, which is George Zimmerman. And then George, based upon what he was saying during the call, he actually starts following Trayvon Martin. And the woman on the phone says, don't follow, she could hear him panting. And she goes, don't follow him. Like, you've told us, you've done your job. We'll come in and do it. And then he says, well, I hate when they get away with this. And so somehow they got into a scuffle. And then George Zimmerman, based upon the law, he had the right to shoot that man. But what should have happened, or at least in the law of the world that I would like to live in, if you initiate that, you lose that right. He initiated anything. All of that was initiated by him. And so I think we need to change the fulcrum from feeling threatened to being threatened, and that person loses their rights if they initiate something. I think that the law needs to change so that, and I've said this probably on your show when we were talking about Rodney King, you know, I think he got hit 56 times. I think there were 3 officers that were involved in the hitting, but there were 24 other officers that were there. I think if a police officer fails to help somebody who is being harmed through excessive force, I think that they should lose their job.
There are a number of proposals that have been made. We talked to the ACLU, and their 2 key priorities were at the state level in Oregon, changing qualified immunity so there could be, in fact, personal responsibility applied to officers who engage in misapplied use of force in unjustified violence. The other of those two was real independent review of independent of the police, review of the police, not merely by the police, of misconduct cases. And there is sort of a suite of proposals that's growing around the state. Colorado did some stuff, Oregon's done some stuff, wants to do some more, New York's done some stuff. As you think about that arc of engagement, somebody who engages an activist, someone who maybe starts out by showing up at a protest or listening to a podcast, listening to the radio, wants to get engaged, any lessons of that arc towards getting engaged and actually changing that damn law, and engaging in, it's about that action, not only about that social media post, not only about showing up at that protest, but also moving towards some degree of structural change. Any lesson that you've learned over the past 30 years or example that helps move somebody along kind of a trajectory of engagement and activism?
I think every person, especially young people, should join a campaign of some type, whether it's an initiative, whether it's a candidate. And I mean this from the bottom of my heart. You know, I certainly have a party. I certainly have beliefs, political beliefs, but I have more respect for people on the other side, and there are other sides, than people who don't get involved at all. Like, I tell young people that you're going to meet more people. You're going to learn about, you know, navigating and working with people. So that's one thing. But the other thing, you know, it's very interesting. And so one of the things that I'm going to do is, I don't really want to talk about this a whole bunch right now, but I'm going to create an institute that's actually going to help people learn how to do these things. And I thank my mentor, because she's the one who taught me how to organize. She, when we were doing all that planning to get that diversity, she says, you know, you guys got to change the policy of the University of Washington, because once you change the policy, that's going to be part of this campus going forward for everybody that inherits it, everybody that comes along. And one of the biggest problems that people have in movements is they don't know how to organize. They don't know how to run meetings, and they don't know how to make decisions. There are lots of decision-making facilitation techniques. And so, you know, that's something that I could do. My background is in educational and communication technology, and I can get a whole bunch of people that I know, and we can help people learn how to do stuff like that, that I think would go a long way into helping to have a sustained efforts that are going to lead to real change.
As you've seen students, are there favorite examples of yours who have moved from sort of an early activist place to a place where they were really moving units and making some change?
Everywhere I've gone, I've been blessed to meet students everywhere. You know, they're the lifeblood of what you do. I think that the things that they have in common is that it's about community building. Community building, you know, what made Mosaic so amazing for all of us is that it was, you know, when I went to Eastern Washington, was where I got my undergraduate degree. When I went to Eastern Washington, I was a Black nationalist. And I saw everything through a Black lens. But one of the great things about going to college is that you're supposed to learn. And I'm still Black. I'm born Black and Black, gonna die Black. But one of the things that was great is I got to meet people from other countries. I think that, so if we had more time, I could give you this taxonomy of people that I find in these five different levels. But at the top level, I call them ambassadors. And the people that I think do the best work, they in their heart and in their soul, they have an ambassador soul where the, you know, like, so I'm gonna give you a very interesting, this is a real story.
Love the story. And by the way, I would, if we have time, I would love to hear the other four levels, even the abbreviated version. But yeah, tell us the ambassador story.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you the levels. So my taxonomy is, so my vision is that going forward, I have this place called the Mosaic Village. And in my village, there are five levels of people that I'm likely to deal with going forward. The first level are enemies. There are people who don't want this village. There are people who are doing everything they can to make sure it doesn't, you know, go forward. And then we have what are visitors. They're people who will come visit the village, but then at the end of the day, they're going to go home and do what they do and be with people that look like them and think like them. Third level are citizens. They're people that kind of buy into this idea. Fourth level, but citizens, they buy in, but they don't necessarily know what to do. The fourth level are what I call diplomats. And they are people that they buy in and they know what to do. And then the fifth level are ambassadors, and they spend all of their time working to get other people to be part of whatever it is that they're trying to do. So, like I said, when I was at Oregon State, I was part of the, you've heard of, I think it's Portland African American Forum, PALF, right?
Yeah, Leadership Forum. Portland African American Leadership Forum.
Yeah, and so, I lived in Corvallis, and as you know, it's a 90-minute drive from Corvallis to where we met, I think where the Urban League was. And so I would go on Saturday, and we had an 8 o'clock meeting for the committee meeting I was in, and then we had a 10 o'clock meeting for the big group to meet. And so, you know, I'm getting up at, you know, 6 to get there by 8 so I can make the first meeting. And then I'm leaving there, you know, at noon. And usually I try to do another thing. So, you know, I finally realized, like, man, I'm giving up my whole weekend to be part of this group. And so I was going to the meeting. I was going to the meeting, and the committee I was on was an education committee. And it was, you know, these beautiful, you know, Black people that I like and I've worked with. But in one particular meeting, I remember they were talking about the school board. And I would love to talk to you one day about that, because I don't know what's the deal with Portland and their superintendents, but oh my gosh. I'm like, the superintendent hasn't been here long enough to make you mad, but that's a different story. But anyway, so we were talking about education. This is a true story. And so in the middle of the meeting, I said, hey, why don't we work with some of the other ethnic groups that might be having the same problem? What do you think happened when I said that to this group of all Black people?
Oh, dear. I will wait to hear your answer.
Yeah. You remember when we were younger, there was this E.F. Hutton commercial that soon as that name...
If Hutton talks, people listen.
Yeah. Yeah. As soon as the name E.F. Hutton was mentioned, everybody stopped what they were doing and they were looking at the person who said it. As soon as I said, hey, why don't we work with the other groups? Everybody looked at me and they were like, one guy was like, this is Black. These are our kids. And if we don't take care of them, no one else is going to take care of them. And, you know, like they were, this one person kind of got mad at me, and then someone else said something else. And then I was a little surprised, right? I'm not from Portland, so I don't try to be from Portland or anything like that. And so I just kind of quieted down. And then I had that moment, you know, I don't know where it came from, but I'm glad that I had it, because the meeting was getting ready to come to an end and we were getting ready to go to the second meeting. And I said, you know what? I want to go back to that, because I asked you all a question about why don't we work in solidarity with those other groups of people. And you started lecturing me about being Black. So first of all, I just want you to know, I am Black, just for the record. And I care about these Black children. But here's what I think. When you go talk to the school district on Monday, they look at you and tell you what you want to hear. When that next group goes talk about their children on Tuesday, the school district tells them what they need. And then you have the other group that comes in on Wednesday and another group that comes in on Thursday. You know what? I said, we all need to go in on Friday. Then they can't ignore us. And then we start working together. And I said, and so I bet you right now, there's a group of Latinx people, there's a group of Native Americans, there's a group of Asian, and there's all these other groups right now meeting somewhere in Portland talking about the school district not helping their kids. I said, so even if you don't want to do it, empower me to do it. But for us to go forward by ourselves, I think, is not going to get us where we need to get. And to the group's credit, they said, you know what? You know, they thanked me for saying it, for speaking up. And that tone after that was much more open to it than said, yeah, you know what? We probably need to revisit it. And unfortunately, it wasn't long after that I ended up leaving to do my tour across the country.
That reminds me of something you said earlier, which was about solidarity. You also mentioned superintendents. Something I've noticed with Portland Public Schools and superintendents is similar to a dynamic I've seen with Portland police chiefs, which is a very significant degree of turnover. Some of that turnover, I think, is dealt by certainly with police chiefs. We've had 8 police chiefs in the same period of time we've had one head of the police union.
Yeah.
Since 2010, we're on our 8th police chief since 2010. And 2010 was when the current head of the Portland Police Association became the head of the Portland Police Association.
Yeah.
And the dynamic, as I would characterize it, is there is an outcry, very often a legitimate one, and they take the head of the head. They say, let's get rid of that chief. Or the superintendent of schools realizes, you know, this, I might not be able to fix all this stuff. I better find another gig. And they move along, either because they're encouraged to or because they just see some writing on the wall. Maybe it's because they're successful to move along. Yeah. But that turnover doesn't seem to lend itself to institutional change, to cultural change within those institutions, to all of the conduct that goes so far beyond that leader. And it feels like something gets done where that changeover happens.
Yeah.
It seems like the work is, as you said, not only about calling out that leader, but by calling in probably more than just that leader.
Yeah, yeah. You know, well, so it's really interesting. I knew a lot of the superintendents here in Seattle. And so when I moved to Oregon, there was a woman, her name was Vicky something. Do you remember her? She was the superintendent of the
Portland. Sure, Vicky Phillips.
And I never really met her. I didn't really know her, but I just remember, like, she hadn't even been there like 2 months and people were like, how can you get mad at someone in their first 2 months? Like, give the person some time. And then Rosie Sizer was she's the former police chief. And I think, is she the first woman police chief for city of Portland?
Boy, I should know the answer to that question. I can look it up, but keep going.
But I know she's one of the few, but she was in my American Leadership Forum class, class 21. And so I got to meet her and hear some of the opportunities and challenges that she had. So the other thing I should say too about the policing is that, another thing that people could do when I was in Corvallis.
I'll interrupt just to say Penny Harrington, it says here, according to my very brief research.
Yeah,
the first woman police chief of Portland Police Bureau back in, she was in the 90s, maybe 90s. Anyway, I'll find it.
Okay, good. Okay, so Rosie was one of the first. So when I was in Corvallis, I was in part of this group called the Citizen Review Board, Police Review Board. And basically, you meet with the police chief. And you talk about, like, they give these reports about, you know, what they're doing, what's working, what's not, the cases that they've had. And it's a great way to know, you know, their opportunities and their challenges. And it's a great way to make a difference. And so I'm not sure how people get on them, but I was lucky enough to get on one of those boards and be part of the solution.
Yeah, I found it. Forgive my being all thumbs earlier. She became police chief in 1985, lasted only 17 months. And ended up writing a book about her experience. Penny Harrington. But Rosie Sizer, I watched as it happened, and so many of the challenges of the police department were then embodied by, or thought to be embodied by, the head of the police chief, the head of the police bureau. And so often that person was appointed because they shared the values, or at least the stated objectives, of the mayor that appointed them. And the mayor at least shared a lot of the stated objectives of the people who voted for him to be mayor. But having that then translate to all of the sergeants, to all of the shift sergeants, to all the captains, to all of the rank and file officers, to the culture of the thing, so much of which does not live inside the city of Portland from night to night, proved to be a very, very challenging thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, there is one thing I do want to say while we're talking about policing that I think needs to be said, and that is that my personal opinion is that one of the changes that we're going to see in what I will go down as a solidarity movement is accountability. That one of the problems that we're living through is that there's no accountability. And I think that the policing in America has had a long time to police itself, and it has failed to do that. And now I think that they're going to be the victim of other people making choices for them that they probably should have made for themselves. They lost that right. by not policing themselves. You know, police know who the police are, the bad police are. They know. You know, they need to fix that. And I think the pressure should come from the outside, but they need to roll up their sleeves and fix it.
And you're right. This is the very thing that's been proposed by Loretta Smith, by Joanne Hardesty here in Portland, that's been on the docket in people's off, either on the top of their tongue or actually proposed for years and years and years, but actually having teeth for independent review, actually having an accountability mechanism that is not only internal affairs, is not only something embedded within the police bureau. I think that your reading of the future, your reading of the Magic 8-Ball also aligns with a bunch of the work of the activists on the ground. Before we wrap, again, we're talking to Terrell Ross, who is the founder of Mosaic, a social justice learning community. And before we wrap, I do want to ask you about the demographic change. We're in the middle of the 2020 census. The big American Community Survey happens in between the big census each year. You have likened the changing demographics in this country to a culture war. Say more about how you see the changing demographics of the country and how we end up managing that.
Yeah, so in essence, I was born 1959, and if I'm not mistaken, we were about 80 something percent white. And now in the next 20 years, we are going to, it'll be a majority of people of color. That's a tremendous change in one lifetime. And the year is supposed to be 2043, where white people will no longer be the majority. It's already happening in the public school system. My nephew, who just turned 9, he will graduate in, I believe, 2030. He'll either graduate or he'll go to college in 2030. And his class will be the first class that the majority of people will be people of color. That's 2030. And so that to me is the most significant change of all, the browning of America. And I don't think that we're ready for it as a nation. And it's not gonna happen, you know, equally in all places. It's gonna happen more in some places and less than others. And I think when I was on your show before, I said that if you were to line up all the states in America from the most diverse to the least diverse 25 years ago, and then you were to line them up a few years ago from most diverse to least diverse, most states move up or down one or two spots. There was one state that moved 15, that was Nevada. There was another state that moved, it was either 10 or 8, and that was Minnesota. And then there was one that moved 6, two that moved 6, and one was Washington and one was Oregon. So Oregon, in order to do this, you have to have a relatively smaller population to move on this chart, and you have to be relatively white. And so what you're gonna see over the next, you know, few years is that, especially Oregon, is going to get a lot of new diversity. So some of the changes that we're gonna see, so let me just wrap up really fast with what we learned in the 2010 census, that the fastest growing race in America was not Latinx, it was actually Asian. And they grew 43.3, and Latinx grew 43. So that was a big surprise. We also know—
That's from between 2000 and 2010?
Yeah, those are results of the 2010 census. And what I think was significant was that 75% of the Latinx population were in 3 states. I believe it's California, Texas, and New York.
Wow.
75%. So I think what you're gonna see is the spreading of Latinx people all over in places that aren't used to that.
Do you think the 2020 census, you will not see the same 75% concentration?
It'll be less, it'll be more widespread all over the nation. But a lot of people are going to deal with the browning of America. Something that we don't talk about a lot is age. And what's important to remember is the age of most Black people in America The other really big deal, every ethnic group in America grew in double digits except for white people. White people only grew 9%, and everyone else was in double digits. And I just told you some groups that were in their 40s,
right?
You know, they grew 40. And so basically speaking, the older white people, you know, I wish I could say it better, but are dying off. The older generation of mostly white people, my generation is mostly white, are dying off. And they're being replaced by these younger generations that are extremely diverse. And also the younger people of color who are here already, most of the Latinx community and the Asian community are in their childbearing years. Most of the Black community and white Americans are not in their childbearing years. So and it's really weird because Black people, age-wise, our ages are very similar to white America age-wise, but the way that we think, we're more in line with what the other people of color are dealing with. And so we kind of have a say-so in the trends, the two trending, because what you have is an older white group that has a little bit more money and is interested in healthcare, not as interested in education. And then you have a younger, more people of color, certainly more women that are interested in things like childcare, interested in education. And so you have one on one plan and one on the other. And Black people kind of, like I said, age-wise and all of that. And so that's kind of what we're dealing with. And so a lot of the problems that we're having in America, they get couched as political problems. So, like I said, we had more time. And you know what's so great? We haven't mentioned Donald Trump one time today. And I'm so happy about that. But one of the advantages that people have is that they couch everything in political terms. And I actually think that we're having a cultural war where, and you're seeing it from the what we've learned from COVID. You know, I'm a veteran. And when I watch football, and sometimes they would have the veterans come out and they honor these veterans at halftime. And I'm so proud to see the other people that I've always thought should be, you know, I've always thought nurses or, you know, librarians or teachers should be honored. And I'm just so happy that bus drivers and all these people who don't normally, people who are picking our food and people who are taking care of our sick are starting to be called essential workers and that they matter. So I think that in this war that we have, I think that we need to call it cultural war and not political war. History is going to be very interesting. And a lot of people obviously are going to talk about the election of Donald Trump. But I actually think that the most profound election was the election of Barack Obama. And I think that Obama, him being elected, changed the way a lot of white people thought. I certainly changed the way a lot of people of color thought. But all these hate crimes started, all these other things started. And I actually think that Donald Trump is... the election of Donald Trump is in reaction to the election of Barack Obama. Because what did he talk about his first 3 years? All he talked about was Obama, Obama, Obama.
I think Ta-Nehisi Coates agrees with you. I think there are a bunch of people who agree with you. And if you combine what you're saying now with the demographic shift, with the culture war you're talking about, heck, I think even Stephen Miller, and I too am glad we have not fixated on the current president, but I think that much of even the unstated but certainly planned purpose is to try to stem that tide, to try to keep the United States from becoming a majority minority nation. I think that's a motivating principle for it's not a bug, it's a feature of some of the movement that's come to run the country.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it comes from I'll send you this article. I have all these articles I can send you, but one of them said that well, it's really bothering, you know, and you know, not all white people are saying, I don't want to put all white people in a monolith, but what's really what I call bothering white America is the loss of power, the loss of status. And I also think that there are some people in white America who feel that when people of color get more power, that we're going to treat white America the same way that they've treated us. I don't think that's going to happen, but I think it's an irrational fear, but it's a fear. And right now, the only way that, the thing that's probably the most important thing, you cannot talk about any of this without talking about white supremacy. What we're talking about is the decline of white supremacy. You know, one thing happened when Donald Trump got elected that seemed like a little thing at the time, but it wasn't. And that was the Tiki Torch protest march that took place in, I believe it was South Carolina. You remember that?
Sure, Charlottesville, yeah?
Charlottesville, thank you. What was so interesting about that is my whole life, all the white supremacists, and I have met white supremacists pretty much everywhere I've gone, they hide themselves from people. Most of them, not all of them. What made that so chilling and frightening is that there were people who took off their masks, they took off their hood, and they marched in public showing their faces. And that was like, we're on. And one of the things that's going on is that part of this war is people are taking down statues. People are defacing statues, which I actually don't agree with, but we can talk about that another time. Now, all the Black Lives Matter stuff that's being put up, there are these vandalists that are doing stuff like that. And so, you know, wars have different fronts. And just because we don't have bullets, massive bullets going back and forth, doesn't mean that we're not at war. You know, there's cold wars, there's guerrilla wars, there's psychological wars, there's economic wars. And, but we are definitely in a war. And I think the gloves are coming off. And the big part of my book is that I think the next 20 years are going to be the contentious phase of this.
One question I got to ask, as we look into the future, there are at least two narratives that one could imagine. There's more, but there are at least two, and I'll put them in opposition. One is that we are in the midst of the decline of the American empire. Somebody like Stephen Miller would equate the decline of white supremacy with the decline of the American empire, linking those two things together. Mm-hmm. My narrative, I'm not prepared to call it a prediction. I might call it a hope, is that we are at a rebirth, at a reimagining of this country, where this country does something that I'm unaware of any other country being able to do at the scale that we would need to do it, which is to have a multiracial, multi-religious, multi-generational movement for social change and social justice, leading to an ascendancy of America's position, if not our military position, at least our position of being a nation that has that can deal with its biggest challenges. How do you see the future? Do you see this more as a period of American decline, more as a period of optimistic American transition, or is that a false dichotomy?
No, actually, I agree with everything you said. I agree that they both are going to happen simultaneously. And they are, it's a war for the future of America. And it actually starts with the 2020 election. And it's going to, my hope is that it's the latter, but I think they're both going to happen at the same time. And so whoever can marshal their people, I do think we're going to have a religious revival. So that's one thing that I suspect in the next.
We'll hear that prediction.
Yeah. The next 5 or 10 years that we're going to have that. So that'll, because, and that would really make a difference, I think. And I think that, you know, I think I said this when I was on your show before, and I think I believe this now, that especially now that maybe we could add climate change, but more lives will be affected by what we do with the inclusion or exclusion of people than any other topic that we choose. Because if we choose to work together, we can solve any problem. We can, you know, most of the problems we have are, or human problems. It's like people who choose to not wear a mask, even though all the research says, you know, wear a mask. Well, there's some things that we need to do to fix the climate, and there's going to be people who are going to choose not to do those things. And so, but I think that this thing called diversity, equity, and inclusion is one of the few places in our society where we actually roll up our sleeves and start to look at it. Now, you said something that I really love. You said a lot of things today that I really love and admire. But you said something that I think people need to think about, and that is let's move away from problem raising to start getting into problem solving. Let's get into problem solving. What does a problem solving agenda look like? And I will end with this for my comments, because I think it's one of the greatest examples of leadership in my lifetime. And that was the leadership of John F. Kennedy when we went to the moon. And I don't know if you know the story, but he made some speech somewhere and he says, you know, we're gonna get to, he'd been talking about it. He says, we're gonna get to the moon by the end of the decade. I think it was like 61 or 62 when he said that. Then he went to his scientists and said, okay, you gotta get us to the moon. And so they said, okay, yeah, yeah. And then about a year or two later, they said, oh, you know what? We can't do this. You know, like there's no way we can get to the moon by the end of the decade. And he goes, you know what? I've done my research. I've given you everything that you've asked for. You have all the resources you need. And you need to go and do what we committed to you doing. He didn't give them their out. He held them accountable. And you know what? We got to the moon by the end of the decade. And you know what that's called? That's called leadership. And I think that is where that's gonna be the change. And it's not gonna be some big movement that comes from up top, but it's gonna be from people listening to themselves. It's gonna be that self-reflection. It's gonna be picking the thing that you can go into that you can add to. You know, bloom where you're planted. What are your gifts? What can you add to this? And then you see it through to completion. Thank you.
Terrell Ross, founder of Mosaic, thank you so much for taking this time, man. It's been good to be with you again. I hope we can do it again.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jefferson. Really enjoyed it. Always do.
All right, be well. We'll talk again.
Bye.
Democracy Nerd is produced and recorded in X-Ray Studios. Thanks to producer Kyle Curtis and Chase Spross. Thanks also to Dan Curtis, Danny C on SoundCloud for the music, and to Kat Buckley for the graphics. I'm Jefferson Smith. We are at the beginning of this. Please subscribe and give us a 5-star review, even if it is only in the hopes that we eventually earn it. Help spread the word. You can check out X-Ray's podcast page, xraypod.com, for past Democracy Nerd episodes and other X-Ray offerings. And thank you, Democracy.